Every now and then, I meet someone who's changing the world for the better by their sheer will alone. Whether they're authors, activists, or adventurers, these people are blazing a path with their deep enthusiasm and allowing the world to follow. Their passion is strong, and my passion is to tell their stories. I am Brian Platt, and this is Passion Project.
Hey. Welcome to the podcast. So in this episode, I speak with John Perlin, the author of A Forest Journey, The Role of Trees and the Fate of Civilization. He originally wrote this book 30 years ago, but has since rewrote and really expanded on a lot of the sections, even adding new sections, talking about different civilizations, talking about the first trees, added a lot more to this already pretty dense edition of the book. Again, that came out about 30 years ago. So he teamed up with Patagonia Press, which you all probably know that I love by now, and has created an incredibly beautiful book about civilizations and the the role that trees and forests have had on either their success or their failure. So a lot of different examples throughout the book, a lot of different examples throughout the podcast, but really fascinating conversations. Like, he talks about how the Stone Age was really the wood age, right? Needing to be able to leverage stones with handles, having these tools that stones were often used for were really useless without handles, without having the that leverage needed for those stones to actually be used as tools. And he talked about how the metal age is really the charcoal age. How in order to make metal, we needed to have fire. Fire needed to be created from somewhere, and it was always created by wood. Wood is charcoal is wood, right? So just talked about how important civilizations' access to forests were. And if they didn't have that access, or if they had already exploited that access, how they went to go find more forest, more trees. It talks about the relationship between England and Ireland and how the English really raised the trees, completely knocked them all down, and used them all in Ireland to attack the Irish. Talked about how that happened in the New World and how a lot of places that we might be familiar with, the Sahara, were big forests before they were taken down. So really, really impressive and incredible stuff. This podcast, we decided there's a couple of times where we had to stop because we had time limitations with Zoom. It was strange. So you might notice a little bit of audio differences between some segments. But we decided pretty early on that we wanted to do a version two of this, or a second edition, rather, of this podcast, because there was so much to go through. Because again, dense book equals dense podcast. So this will be version one, or I guess I keep saying version, but this will be chapter one of a two, potentially three-part podcast. But again, I really hope you enjoy this podcast. It was a pleasure for me to record, to speak with John, and I really hope you get the same enjoyment out of listening to him as I did. Thanks.
Okay. Well, John, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate this. I'm very excited for this podcast episode.
Yeah, my pleasure. Let's do it.
Well, great. Well, I want to talk about your book and about how incredible it is. The Forest Journey, The Roles of Trees and the Fate of Civilization. I learned so much from this book. I've got a lot of questions for you, but I learned so much from this book about human relations with trees, with forests. We know how important they are, at least I hope most of us do, but I had no idea how important they have been to humanity throughout the course of their history and how underappreciated, even still, they are to this day. And yeah, I want to thank you so much for writing this. You wrote it initially 30 years ago, and this is a expanded and updated version, and it's absolutely incredible. I think it's one of the most beautiful books I've ever had a chance to read. I've ever even had a chance to kind of flip through and hold. Some of the most incredible photography and incredibly, incredibly well-researched and very, very thorough. So thank you for the opportunity to read this book and for your time of writing it initially and for updating it 30 years down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I've been like, I was preparing for the event when somebody would come along and want to do a new edition. So I was accumulating all these years you know, all sorts of new material.
Yeah, and that's kind of my first question is what made you want to expand on the book, rewrite the book? There's a significant amount of new material in it. What was the driving force behind revisiting this 30 years later?
Well, it was a total, like all my life, total serendipity. A local, you know, I'm sure in your town, you have a local weekly paper that's distributed freely.
Yes.
And they did a profile on me for a whole other aspect of my endeavors. And Patagonia is only 35 miles south of Santa Barbara. And Chouinards, who are the owners of Patagonia, said a forest journey was their favorite work. And they always wanted to do a new version. And so out of the blue, you know, they sent a email to the editor of the, you know, weekly paper. Is can you get in touch with John Perlin? And that's how it all began. Wow. This new edition.
That must have been incredible in and of itself with Yvonne reaching out to you about how much of an impact this book has had on him. I mean, if you talk about some of the top conservationists / top businessmen, he's the top of both of those lists.
Right. I mean, what can I say? I was really excited. And we met in Santa Barbara for lunch and carved out a contract, and away we went.
So what has...
And I'd all... Yeah?
Sorry. No, keep going. No, please.
Well, I had all these ideas that I wanted to add I had dug up, and so suddenly I had the opportunity to plant new trees.
I love that. And yeah, that's my question. It's like, what did you have in mind to update? I know research in the past 30 years had changed significantly, so there was a lot more at your fingertips, this namely the internet, but like even a lot more research that's in the internet that was discovered in the past 30 years that you didn't have back then, or at least wasn't readily available. Was that kind of part of what spawned your kickstarted some of the ideas that you had?
Well, first of all, I wanted to make it more inclusive, to cover more cultures than just Western world. And so I got that opportunity. And most of that was done with what you call hardcover books from translations of Chinese myth or fable, Indian religious work. Also meeting people. I got to meet an archaeologist who discovered that Africans had developed steel over 1,000 years before Europeans.
Wow.
And just wild stuff. Like, and it was just totally on the fly in that talking to that person or this person, they'd lead me to another person, right?
Yeah.
And so there it went. The book was primarily focused on Western culture in the original edition, and now the Chinese are covered, the East Indians are covered, this Stone Age, which I show should be called the Wood Age, is covered. But the biggest find that I really wanted to share was in 2017, I spent 2 weeks in Western Pennsylvania digging the fossils of the first true tree, Archaeopteryx, which started the whole tree idea on Earth 380 million years ago. And I have all this in my house, like all these fossils of the trunks. And in fact, I could hold one second, I'll show you.
Oh yeah, that'd be great.
Here is 380 million
Wow.
year old bark.
Okay, let me try and explain that, because that looks like a piece of slate. I mean, there are
Slate,
straight, very
exactly.
straight lines.
Exactly.
It's almost a rectangle with part of
Right.
the
Can
top right
you see
missing.
the can you see the oh
Oh, the bark indentations?
yeah, so
Wow.
the
Yeah.
indentation.
But still, that looks
Yeah,
very
so
much, if I didn't know any better, I would say that's slate. That looks very
it is
much.
slate.
Okay,
It
there you
is
go.
slate.
Yeah.
What happened was this first true tree changed. What we say is it became a geoengineer, where it changed the entire configuration of the earth by taming, you might say, the earth. And so the torrential rains suddenly became well-ordered rivers thanks to their deep roots. And so what that did was it allowed the debris to fall to the bottom of the riverbed. They call them oxbow rivers, where they sort of wind around. And so all this debris could fall into the river and be covered. And as you had more and more pressure, you develop slate, which is a sedimentary rock. And the contents of the tree got, and that's what we call a fossil, got buried inside and became rock.
Wow. Wow.
So here I had, like, I actually, in 1999, there was an article in Nature magazine called Archaeopteryx is the First True Tree. And suddenly I said, I gotta have this in a forest journey, right? But I didn't have anybody who wanted to, redo the book. And so it was 18 years later that I got this whole opportunity to begin the book in a whole different way.
Wow.
The story of the first true tree and how it changed the world. And how it changed the world was, example, like changing the landscape, but also changing the, you might say, the atmosphere-scape, because what it did was it took in carbon dioxide to photosynthesize and released oxygen into the atmosphere, creating a more modern atmosphere that allowed life to flourish.
So two questions for that, because you actually, I had a question just on that, but like before Archaeopteryx was not, before 1999, it was not a
Right.
known entity. Like no one really, it
Oh
was discovered, right?
no. Oh,
Or
actually, it's a very interesting evolution. In 1870s, they discovered like fern-like leaves, and next to it were fossilized trunks. So they called the fern-like leaves fossilized leaves Archaeopteryx, and called the trunks Calexlon. And so
Okay.
they were like, they thought they were two different species, and then in 1960, a botanist who was digging fossils in the Catskills found the leaves on a branch that belonged to the wood that they previously had thought was a separate species. So suddenly they had what they called a transition fossil, which is one of the few links that Darwinian evolution requires. They had the leaves of oh the leaves of ancient plants but they had a trunk that was similar to the modern pine tree. So here they had like the old and the new, and I call this tree the tree that creationists hate,
right?
Because it definitely like proves. Actually, the leaves were fern leaves.
That kind of makes sense, yeah, in that arid climate.
Well, also ferns like were earlier than you know, other plants. Gotcha. And they were also, and also what made the tree different and what makes it so interesting is also it had deep roots, unlike any other plant in that world, in Devonian world. And even more amazing is because the debris coming from the tree would eutrophy, you know, take the oxygen out of water.
Mm-hmm.
It killed off a great number of fish. And the only fish that could survive were the lungfish because they could breathe oxygen. Huh. And so they, you know, I don't know how much you know about lungfishes. They can walk on land.
Mm-hmm.
And they also can live on land for a number of years.
Oh, I did not know that.
And so the lungfish became the first terrestrial animals. And the reason why they could survive on Earth was that the oxygen that the Archaeopteryx provided allowed them to metabolize. Prior to that, on Earth, you could only have very little, very small insects because of the lack of oxygen.
That's wild.
So what I call it, what I call Archaeopteryx, is the tree that changed the world.
Because the oxygen it pulled out of the surrounding water made it so it was unable for any other fish to survive. And so lungfish were the only ones that just survived, and they could get on land, and they had the oxygen, again, provided by Archaeopteryx.
And also they could, like, and one of the advantages for the lungfish was that, I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of Devonian fish. They're awfully aggressive. They about a third of a Devonian fish is devoted to jaws.
Oh, okay.
And huge teeth. And so the little lungfish didn't stand a very, you know, good chance of surviving. But because of this one, you might say, gift, having lungs, they could outlast the their predators.
Yep, I'm looking
and at start to settle and start to settle on land.
Wow.
And it was in 2015 that they discovered that lungfish could walk. A expert on lungfish was just messing around in his lab, and he noticed that his lungfish in the aquarium would move up on the bottom of the aquarium. And so suddenly they realized that it was a lungfish that links us to you know, to our ancestors. So that began the book. And also because the Earth was just one continent at the time, Galantaland, Archaeopteryx could easily spread.
That was my other question.
And so the whole huge continent became forested, and suddenly everything started to drastically change.
That was my exact other question, is how long was its reign and how far spread it was, because obviously you had the entire continent.
Okay. Gowandaland was you know, basically a conglomerate of all the Earth land that we have today in one unit. So it was huge.
Yeah.
And also tree, Archaeopteryx, easily spread because of its advantage. It was the first plant that could survive outside of a moist area because of its deep roots.
Gotcha. Can I ask you a question? Why is it, when I grew up, it was Pangaea? Is it no longer Pangaea is what it's called?
That's later.
Okay, gotcha.
There's two time periods where the Earth was just a unitary landmass.
Okay.
So Pangaea, Gondwanaland is actually named after a formation in central India.
Gotcha. Okay. And so we're talking about Archaeopteryx, the first quote unquote tree. But however,
the first tree, everything, deep roots, trunk, branches, leaves.
Do we know how
everything
tall?
That makes a tree? What?
Do we know how tall they were?
Yeah, about 100 feet.
And so in the beginning of your book, you mentioned the end Permian extinction.
Okay, the end Permian extinction is 251 million years ago. You had this, it's actually very interesting because it's very, are you familiar with the tar sands?
Yeah, actually I am.
Well, it was an event that sort of tar sands is very similar to, where you had this huge amount of volcanic activity, but it wasn't the volcanic activity that destroyed life on Earth. It was the pouring down of the lava on these petroleum-based rocks, and that created a huge amount of carbon dioxide, creating a very high temperature. So all the successors of Archaeopteryx could not photosynthesize, and they all died. And so what happened is all the herbivores died because they no longer had like the leaves to eat. And with the herbivores no longer available, the carnivores died. It's called the time when we almost lost life on Earth.
Which is unbelievable. And you talk about Archaeopteryx's successor, but I'm very, like, the process starts over. It had to start almost entirely over from scratch. Like, how
right,
did that...
It took,
yeah.
It took 5 million years, which shows the danger of, it's very similar to, actually, Archaeopteryx, you might say, is the Garden of Eden. And the end Permian extinction is very similar to what we're generating today. And instead of like volcanoes and lava, they're smokestacks.
Yeah.
And cars, cars are little smokestacks.
Yeah.
It's all like filling up the earth with carbon dioxide, just as happened at the end Permian extinction. When we almost lost, 90% of the animals on Earth. Actually, nobody, I really surprise people when I tell people that at that point, and it was before the dinosaurs, we had proto-mammals, actually, very much spread throughout the planet.
Wow.
This is before the event, and all the proto-mammals died, and the only survivors were like little reptiles, and those reptiles, in millions of years evolved into dinosaurs.
And you do such a good job of exactly what you just said, painting that picture with how it was 250 million years ago to how it could be today, if we're not careful.
Right, and I was very fortunate, and this is what really makes the book, I think, so wonderful, is that I always was able to get the best people to help me out. For example, I got Chris Mays, who is the leading authority on the end Permian extinction, to become, collegial and to oversee what I was, producing about that time period. And also I was able to get other people for example, experts on Archaeopteris to oversee, you know, what I was doing there. So everything I did in that book, I fortunately got the best people to evaluate what I was writing. And also learning from them, like Chris Mays, for example. I didn't have that much on deforestation and the end permanent extinction. And suddenly I get this urgent email, and he said, "You have to read my new paper where, you know, the deforestation, it was one of the main causes of the end permanent extinction."
And this is all, everything we've spoken about is all within the first 10 pages of your book, of the newest edition.
Yeah, the first 10 pages. And then I go into, and this is new material too, and it comes from new work in archaeology, is we think of the Stone Age as people like with using stones, right?
Yeah.
And it turns out that the stone implements would have been totally useless if they didn't have like wooden handles. And nobody thought of that until recently, about a decade ago. And they started discovering in the, I guess the little aperture of the stone, evidence of wood. And then I have access to a lot of open space above my place. So I could, you know, like get a stone and try to break something with it, and then get a tool with a handle and try to break something with it. And wow, what a difference.
How much easier it is.
Also, for example, the Indians use fire to, to fell their trees, because they didn't have metal.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, you do such. Go ahead.
So you can imagine how time consuming that was compared to a Neanderthal who had developed a handle for an axe.
Right. And how are they starting the fires too? Right, they're probably starting the fires.
Yeah, well, see that. And now we get into how I first said, "Wow, I think I have a story here." I was working on the history of solar energy, my first book.
Yeah,
and what I discovered was the reason why people went to solar in antiquity was because they were, no matter whether it was China or Greece or Rome, they were always running out of wood for fuel by deforesting, you know, the land. And so I said, "Oh my God, this is a story that I didn't understand why no one had covered it." That suddenly I got this idea, and this is the first paragraph I wrote, that trees are the primary fuel and primary building material of almost every civilization until the discovery of fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. So for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, if you didn't have wood, it was curtains. And the reason for example, colonization in most cases was to get wood. Because also remember that until the monitor, you're familiar with the Monitor and the Merrimack?
I am, yeah.
Oh, cool. Well, the iron ships. Well, until the Monitor and the Merrimack, every ship was wood, made of wood. Mm-hmm. And so you would have never had the exploration from Europe to Americas without wood. You wouldn't have never had a viable England without wood, because what made England so different was they called it the wooden walls of England, you know, the ships. And the ships, because you didn't have engines, you had sails, right?
Right.
And so
right.
You required like huge, you know, timbers. as masts, because you had ships that were, say, had 280 guns, right? And when you go, and you have what was called ships of the line, right? And so you would line up, and then you would fire like 280 cannons at one time. And if you didn't have robust masts, you know, you would have, you know, sunk.
I mean, it's
so you had to follow the wood to maintain a vital country. And that is why I think you're in New Jersey, right?
I'm in North Carolina.
Oh, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Oh, North Carolina is another story. That's where the English, you know, tapped all the all the tar for their sails and for the cord.
Yes, yes. Actually, right where I am, you on the that? Coast, on Wilmington. We hear about that quite a lot.
Yeah.
Where the tallest trees were taken for that reason.
Right, right, right. So England, because they were running out of wood in England, they looked as a existential necessity, the colonies, because it was in the colonies, for example, like in New England, where the great white pines grew, that they required for masting, because two things were happening in Europe. One was the trees were getting a lot smaller in Northern Europe because, you know, as you cut down the big trees, you change the genome.
Mm-hmm.
And only smaller, like wimpier trees survive because you leave them alone.
Yeah.
You know, and also, and this is exactly, and this is amazing, this is exactly what's happening in the Red Sea right now. The Dutch would, you know, create a blockade, right?
Mm-hmm.
To keep the English out of the wood countries of Scandinavia. So they couldn't so they have a really weak navy, because Holland and, you know, the UK at that time were great enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And so the English looked to the colonies as their mass supply, and avoided that blockade. And also, you're familiar with Hamlet, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, well, the reason why Elsinore was so powerful was Elsinore, like, holds the access to the Baltic, because if you look at Denmark, you have all these little islands which are blocking, mm-hmm, basically the entrance and exit of the Baltic. And so Elsinore commanded the narrowest straits, and with their cannons, they could cause a major kerfuffle, right? A major, mm-hmm, debacle by blockading someone's access to the big trees in Norway and Sweden, for example.
And you talk about that experience a couple of times, where a culture's access or lack of access to trees and to forests has either worked in their favor, where they were able to expand greatly, or worked to their demise, where they were not.
Right, 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 right. Well, what's fascinating is, for example, wood-rich Macedonia, for example, was able to, control all of Greece and the world. However, when the Romans conquered Macedonia, the first thing they did was prohibited the Macedonians from felling any trees, because of their importance.
Wow.
So what I found was these great aspects of society and civilization that no one had accounted for in the why they moved westward. For example, why Greece? You know, Greece looked at Italy, and my Italian friends just laughed because, you know, Italy is now just totally without a tree. They looked at Italy as we looked at the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
It was their great wood supply. In fact, the Peloponnesian Wars, one of the reasons why Athens failed was because they went to Syracuse to take the timber, and the rulers of Syracuse didn't think that was a good idea. And so they lost the battle in Syracuse, and then Athens became totally vulnerable to its enemies in the east. But also, we would be speaking Persian if not for Greece's access to wood for two reasons. One is they needed silver to pay for their navy. Mm-hmm. And to get silver ore, and this is why another interesting aspect I show is that everyone talks about the Middle Ages, but you wouldn't have any metal without wood, because you require charcoal, which is a derivative of wood, to raise the temperature to extract the metal out of the rock, because only 5% of the world's metal is what we call native. The rest is ore.
Hmm.
So you would have no Middle Ages without trees. And so the Greeks found this rich vein of silver ore, but silver ore is only 3% silver, and the rest is, I guess you call debris, right? And so you have to have a high flame to remove that silver to, get the silver, to smelt the silver.
Yeah.
And they needed the silver to pay for the wood to build the fleet that defeated the Persians, who were already almost to Athens. And there was this great battle called the Battle of Salamis. Once again, wooden ships.
Mm-hmm.
And the Greeks defeated the fleet of Persia. And that's why we speak a language that's a Latinate rather than Indo-European.
Yeah, I think throughout Yeah, you can go ahead.
No. And so just all these events started to come into my brain. What I did was I taught myself in all the languages that I was going to cover how the word, various trees are, named, how wood is called, and then found lexicons, which then guided me to the literature, and then had people translate for me the various languages. I even had a professor at University of California, Santa Barbara, to translate a cuneiform for me. So we were talking about the fact that I would learn the different words for tree, for kinds of trees like oak, pine, in all the languages that I was planning to research in. And then I would take the material I found from the lexicons in, say, Greek, Latin, whatever, and go to the various people I knew who would translate for me.
I mean, there was so much work that went into not only the first, iteration of this book, but the most recent. I'm just still so impressed. Yeah, I'm just still so in love with the way that you rewrote history for me. And I kind of wanted to read something from your passage.
Sure.
And you've been touching on it this whole time, but it just really put it into perspective. So this occurred for simple reasons. Trees have been the principal fuel and building material of almost every society for over a millennia. To this day, trees still fulfill this role for a majority of people who inhabit our planet. Without vast supplies of wood, fells from forests, the great civilizations would never have emerged. Without charcoal, metallurgy would never have arisen. Wood, in fact, is the unsung hero of the technological revolution that has brought us from the stone and bone culture to our present age. And then you go on to talk about kind of what we've been talking about, like heat from fires would be virtually impossible. The handles of tools would be impossible. Transportation, mine shafts to actually get that ore and that coal up. Gun stocks, arrows, looms for wool to create wool, barrels for beverages, like so much that you think about, but not really in this context of really kind of everything relies on culture's accessibility to trees and to forests. And without that, or with the abuse or misuse of that, they can be doomed. And we were talking a little bit about how that has impacted society, about the either access to the trees or access to cultures and new worlds that might have those trees.
Well, chew on this. We could have never left. Humans could have never left Africa if there were no trees.
Shipbuilding?
Because there would be no. There would, because first of all, there would be no fire. And how could you survive in a, like a European setting with snow and, freezing temperatures or even if you're in the tropics, how do you cook food?
Yeah.
I see, that's what boggled my mind when I first encountered this, is why hadn't some, mind far greater than mine, ever thought about this. I just couldn't believe it. And so suddenly it was just this wide open field, because there had never been, looked at, is that first sentence you read, that without, basically everything still today, and as I show in the epilogue, and a lot of it comes from from really new discoveries of what trees do, we're more existentially dependent on trees now than ever before. And that's because, well, first of all, as a carbon sink, but beyond a carbon sink, trans evaporation of leaves creates rain. One of the fascinating things I learned is that only 20 years ago, people thought that rain only came from evaporation of the ocean waters. And in the last 20, 30 years, they've discovered that it's the trans evaporation of the leaves. Because what happens, with photosynthesis, trees are amazing, because they're the only, being, you might say, that can cause water to rise uphill, right?
Sure, yeah.
Fill the leaves with water, because water is the catalyst for photosynthesis, because it's water and the carbon dioxide that the energy of the sun allows to create this chemical reaction that produces the food that builds the tree. You're aware of that, right?
Yeah.
Oh, we have what's called chloroplasts. And this is really interesting too, for me at least, is that the leaf, up until Einstein, people believed that light traveled as waves. But there were certain anomalies that didn't fit that paradigm. And so all science was up in an uproar, and Einstein discovered that light is both a wave and a particle, and a particle with energy. And it's those energized particles that hit the chloroplasts and cause the chemical reaction of the water and the carbon dioxide. You have water coming from the ground, and you have carbon dioxide being absorbed by the stomata, little holes in the bottom of the leaf, and it's and you create electrical current. Actually, you can put a volt a ammeter in a trunk, and you can get an electrical charge.
Wow!
Because what's happening is the electricity from the light particles is creating this chemical reaction, where the tree gets its food. But in the process, only, like, I think it's only 3 or 4% of the water in the leaf is required. And the rest of it goes up into the air and creates clouds and mist, which eventually turn into rain. And they call the Amazon, like, oh, not only do you have the Amazon River, but you have the River of the Sky, which creates the Amazon River.
Wow.
And so as they deforest the Amazon, areas that were dependent on the rain that was created by this evapotranspiration are now like the reservoirs are drying up. In fact, 40%, for example, 44% of the water in the Nile comes from the evapotranspiration of the jungles in the Congo.
Wow. How could they determine that?
And what?
How could they determine that? That's wild.
Science can do it.
Yeah.
And so not only do trees serve as carbon sinks, which we need so badly, but they also create rain, and they also act like a medley, like a relay.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, the trees in Scandinavia and in Siberia move the rain to China, for example.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
So you cut down those trees and you have no water. And for example, Mexico City, they say in about 6 months, will not have no drinking water.
Wow. And that's the thing is like, I feel like, and this is one of my questions, but I feel like at least collectively, or maybe individually, public sentiment towards trees in the past 30 years, people have realized how important they are, or that they are more important than maybe we thought. Your A Forest Journey is outlining how much more important than I could have ever have guessed trees are to the past, to the present, and to the future. Again, someone who loves trees, who loves forests, who loves conservation, I just had no idea how big of an impact they had.
What's really interesting is in the Bible, in Isaiah, they talk about, he talks about when the Messiah comes, they'll plant the trees in the in the deforested areas. And what the trees will do is create water for the people in that area to finally have enough drinkable water.
Hmm.
Isaiah 41, I think it's that verse 41, where they say when the Messiah comes, they'll plant the pine, they'll plant the cedar, they'll plant the box, and then water will abound again.
Wow. Yeah.
And so that's like that. And also in Isaiah, he talks about, and just what earlier we were talking about, is how societies, as they grow, they devour trees, and they have to move towards the trees. They talk about, Isaiah says he makes himself into an oak, and he says how happy he is because the ruler of Assyria has been killed. And so now no one will come up and cut him down.
Wow. And that's interesting because your book, it's divided distinctly into two chapters, into two parts, we'll say. You have the old world and the new world. I find that.
I mean, can you imagine?
Yeah.
Can you imagine? I mean, it's just incredible. Like new information shows that, for example, where I live in Southern California, where we believe that chaparral was always the way things were, that 11,000 years ago, it was juniper and oak, but the first people to come there burnt down all the trees and created a basically a very dry dry landscape, which we considered normal.
What were you most surprised of that used to be a forest? I know you actually mentioned the Sahara used to be a forest.
What I couldn't believe, like, as I was reading the accounts from the ancient time periods of the hills above Iraq.
Yeah.
Were all trees and huge trees, trees like we have in the Pacific Northwest.
They're like redwoods, right?
And then you saw, no, they were actually junipers.
Okay.
They call them cedars because the first story of deforestation comes to us in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which I have a whole chapter on. Mm-hmm. And it's called the episode is called The Forest Journey, and that's where I got the title for my book. And they go and they say they cut down all the cedars. Well, they're really cutting down the junipers, but they're huge trees, and they would like snake down the Euphrates to the various Mesopotamian kingdoms. And so at first the story of Gilgamesh happens in eastern Iran. And then as they deforest that area, it moves westward as time goes by. And I just couldn't believe, I constantly like a surprises. Like, for example, who would have thought that in the Middle East there were, elephants?
Wow.
Like numbering greater than in Africa.
And you said a large part of this. Go ahead. No, keep going. I really want to hear this.
So what happened was, as they cut down the trees, elephants no longer had, they're herbivorous, right? They no longer had their food, and they all like became extinct. And I thought this might be like a tale or something, but then they've discovered like ancient bones of elephants in Syria, in northern Syria. I mean, who would think these lands once were all covered with wood? Wow. You know, all these countries like Israel, all these countries were great forests.
Wow. I mean, you even talk about Ireland, right? We're known as being very green, but maybe not as tree dense as it was. But it was. It was, right? Yeah.
Oh, you're talking. You're talk about mind blowing. The British in the 1600s decided that the way they would enhance the British Empire was to conquer England and conquer Ireland. And in the process, they would do three things. One is they would enhance England's wood supply. Two, they would prevent the rebellious Irish from hiding in the woods. And three, they would bring great industry to these lazy Irish people.
And they use the trees against Ireland,
right? In
well, they not only used it against. I understood why Irish hate England was because you know, Ireland used to be greatly forested, and what did Britain get? Well, they got all the casks, you know, to hold the beer, which really sustained the world. And they gained wood to smelt iron in Ireland, which impoverished Ireland. So all these, you know, I was just like in constant awe of inquiring all this new information that nobody ever had brought about, had ever thought about.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, who would think that the reason why the British wanted New York was because they wanted to prevent the Dutch, who were, you know, settled in New Amsterdam, which became New York, you know, its great wood supply, you know, that's, they wanted to keep the Dutch away from the supply of wood, and they wanted the wood for the British Empire.
Yeah.
So I learned so much as I, or you take North Africa. I mean, who would think that North Africa was the Pacific Northwest of the Romans, where 500 ships would make constant trips to that area to collect the great wood to heat the Roman baths.
Yeah. You know, what I really learned, one of the things, because I learned so much, is that I always thought deforestation was a relatively newer trend, right? I just call it maybe recency bias or whatever, but I always thought that it's perpetuated and it's gotten a lot worse. But there were periods of time where it was, I mean, you're outlining right now, where it was incredibly bad. And I'm looking to you for this quote, because there was, I think it might have been when you were talking about the Fertile Crescent, but, or the Epic of Gilgamesh, where they're floating in the river and they're like, what did we do to this paradise?
Yeah. I mean, this was the amazing thing. About 10 years ago, see, they find all sorts of different tablets in different parts of the Middle Eastern world of the story of Gilgamesh. You know, they have like, they call the Hittite Gilgamesh, you know, from Turkey. Babylonian Gilgamesh, you know, from central Mesopotamia. And they found in 2008, it's called the ecological Gilgamesh, where for the first time in the story, you hear all the beauty of the forest, all the animals are, you know, depicted by the author. And after they cut down the trees, they're coasting down the Euphrates, you know, on these rafts. And suddenly, Gilgamesh, who's the king, you know, who's, you know, wanting this wood to build a great city. His companion looks at him and says, I think we've turned the cedar forest into a wasteland. What are we going to tell our gods?
Wow.
The first voice of environmentalism. What are we going to tell our future?
And largely, we still haven't learned that lesson.
Right. So, yeah, it's a great, you know, that's another, new addition to a forest journey was, the 2008 discovery of the ecological Gilgamesh, which is now included. Also, in 2001, the definitive translation of Gilgamesh also provided me with great new material. One of the interesting examples is the guardian of the forest was actually an elephant. And he was, you know, trying to protect his habitat.
Yeah. Wow.
And And so the, and this was all written on clay tablets, 5,340 years ago. And it predicts exactly how every society has taken down their trees. First of all, Gilgamesh, who's the you might say the leader of the pack, he first builds a road, right? And once you build a road, the forests are, forget the forests. I mean, that's exactly what happened in the Amazon.
Yep.
Is the World Bank sponsored building of a road. And suddenly, you know, the Amazon goes down. In Africa, you know, build the road into the, in the Cameroons, for example. And suddenly the great trees there go down. And another part of the book, which is totally new, is how trees protect us from, pandemics.
Yes.
Is what happens is because the road goes from the wilderness to the city, you have the diseases that have been kept at bay in the forest. Mm. Once you start cutting, you know, diseases like Ebola and like coronavirus are brought into contact with people who prior, you know, kept out of this, these areas.
Yeah, that was very
and
timely.
Also what you have, also what you had happening is just another way the forest protects us is it allows the survival of what's called specialized species, which are predators. And so once the forests go down, we lose the predators, mm-hmm. and the survivors are the general animals, which are like bats. And this is another amazing, I couldn't believe, how did I find it? In 2018, I found a article in one of the best journals in microbiology. It was called Bats, Deforestation, and Coronaviruses.
Wow.
And this was 2018.
Wow.
Wow. 2 years before. And the whole argument was you take down the forest, the bats, you know, proliferate because bats do really well where there's lighting, because lighting, you know, attracts the insects. And so they just have a great time. But as they emphasize, bats are like collectors of virus. They've sort of made peace with the coronavirus. Somehow the coronavirus doesn't affect them in the bloodstream.
Yeah,
so they're great,
a lot of viruses
like, carriers. They're great carriers, mm-hmm. is what I'm trying to say. And but when they get in contact with humans, they piss, they shit, and all that virus sheds, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so here we had in 2018, and the warning was, and this is exactly what the scientists wrote, is that because humans are naive to this novel virus, you know, there's going to be hell to pay.
Wow.
And this wasn't like an afterthought. This was a beforethought.
Right. Which is incredible. It's mind-blowing to me when I'm telling you that you changed the way I thought about civilization and about our relationship with trees. I mean, it makes total sense. I mean, you said it kind of at the beginning, like the stone... Oh. All right, we got 10 minutes left in this, but I'll see what I can do. I just got an alert. But the Stone Age is really the Wood Age. The Metal Age is really the Charcoal Age. Like, these ways of thinking were complete paradigm shifts for me, but totally makes sense.
For me too, man. Yeah. You know, like, you know, you know, like oh, I think there was a movie called Network, and they have the guy who goes really nuts on the
mad TV as hell
and says, "Why me?"
Yeah, okay, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And fortunately, I have the support of the leading professor of the history of technology, because he was a big admirer of my first book.
Yeah.
So he provided me with the wherewithal to, you might say, conquer the university library, because the University of California has a very powerful system where not only can you get books from the library at UCSB, you know, where I'm at, University of California, Santa Barbara, but also there's a called Interlibrary Loan,
yes,
where you can get books throughout the world. And so that really helped out, because he gave me a faculty card.
Wow.
Which has tremendous power.
Yeah.
And then also, there was this librarian at the University of California, Santa Barbara, named Lieselotte Fajardo. And it turns out she was a very interesting woman, in that she was one quarter Jewish during Kristallnacht in Germany.
Wow.
And yeah. Suddenly,
wow.
And suddenly, being just one quarter Jewish, her whole life changed.
Yeah.
And she actually grew up in Shanghai. And somehow she became a mistress of multiple languages. And so she volunteered to translate, you know, I think it was French, Dutch, German for me. So I had these wonderful people, and, you know, so I was very fortunate. But, you know, I'd really like to, Patagonia really liked this piece I wrote, because basically, for the first 4 years, it was just horrid, because I really thought I had, you know, the greatest ideas of the world, and no one was agreeing with me. And so I actually lived in a friend's backyard for 4 years, and waking up on the grass and going to the university library every morning after wiping the grass off me.
What a great story. Talk about dedicated.
Well, not only that, but this environmental organization, they didn't like me. And this was really funny, because I would ride my bike to their headquarters in Santa Barbara.
Okay.
Because that's not professional. You know, you're supposed to drive a car.
Oh, wow. What a great environmental organization.
Yeah, right. So they kicked me out. But this woman, Selma Rubin, she thought I was brilliant, and she thought my ideas were amazing. So she lived in a very wealthy area of Santa Barbara, and she got me an Apple IIe computer to, you know, to do word processing, to write the manuscript. And also she gave me a key. She made a little office for me in the laundry room of her estate.
Oh, wow.
And I could come, you know, I was camping out in about 10 miles north, and I could ride my bike to her makeshift office and have all my work, you know, organized in an office space. So I had these wonderful people. And so when the book finally got published, we had a big dinner at her estate for all the people who believed in me.
Wow.
I mean, you can imagine, what is this guy, totally nutty? He's saying that wood is the primary building material and the primary fuel of civilization. And it turns out this thesis is universal, even for the American Indians, for example, I've been writing several pieces. I could send you them on LinkedIn.
Please. Yeah.
On how they deforested great amounts of land, mm-hmm. because their people, they need, you know, especially on the East Coast, right? Especially in New England, where it gets colder than, you know, how are you going to heat yourself in wintertime? How are you going to cook your food?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then what is most amazing is they would actually hollow out their canoes because they didn't have metal tools. They would hollow out their canoes with fire.
Yeah.
And then how would they, like, how would they travel by river to fish or to move without wood, right? There's no way you can have an ocean-going craft out of any other material until the Merrimack and Monitor came.
Exactly.
That's a real interesting story where, you know, England had like planned, you know, its whole next 1,000 years on finding more wood. And suddenly the Merrimack and the Monitor go to it. 2 weeks later, Parliament says the age of wood for ships is gone. What I found, you know, is technology, like I said, all the solar, we call it passive solar,
right?
That housed everyone in Greece, everyone, well, Rome used all their they designed all their baths to take advantage of solar energy. And the reason for that was, you know, they were running out of wood.
Yes. Okay. And that's what got you to write the A Forester to begin with.
That's what got me. I write that in the first, I think, introduction to forestry. I said, I surmised, you know, that it was very parallel to why are we in trouble in the Middle East? It doesn't happen that we love sand, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, these countries have nothing, but they have one thing, and that's the primary fuel of today's civilization.
Wow, oil. Yeah, that's when you talk about resources. Like, again, this is probably my own modern head, but I'm always thinking of oil or minerals. But like the primary resource for millennia was trees, right? That's the reason we were able to access
even the age of fossil fuels, they were trees. Because what is coal? Coal is merely trees, ancient trees that have been compressed. All the moisture is removed, and they're pure, coal or charcoal.
Yeah.
And that's why charcoal was such a preferred fuel over wood, because there was none of the moisture that you had to mess around with. Because what you wanted was a very high flame, and you wanted a flame that you could depend upon.
Long burning.
And the only way you could do that is with pure carbon.
Wow.
So once they learned how to make carbon, you know, make charcoal, you know, the forest days were numbered.
Right.
And that's where we get the Middle Ages.
Wow.
Because even as we enter the fossil fuel age, we're just dealing with trees too. Just different forms. Compressed trees.
So it looks like we have about a minute left. I think we're going to get kicked out again. I'm going to have to. Oh.
It's right on time, isn't it? I don't know if you can hear me. I'll create one more. But here's the thing. I like your idea. I'll give you a link to click.
I like your idea of doing a version two. I think that I just had a couple more end questions. I think maybe even just one. And I'll send you a link. And you should be able to click on that. We should be back in the same space. One second. I got to shut my door again. So if you can click that link that I sent, because again, I can't hear you. Yep, there you are.
Okay,
there you are.
Here I am again, the third coming of John Perlin. He keeps popping up like a jack in the box. You don't want him.
No, I love it because, like okay. I said, my mind is continually blown. So I'm happy to do however you want to. I think it definitely merits a second conversation. I'll probably publish this one too, just to make sure, like in the meantime, just to make sure it gets published.
Sure.
I had a couple other questions, but I wanted to be respectful of your time today. So I can actually just ask one more question and we can branch off that.
Go for it.
Okay. But also, like, if we want to talk for longer, I'm happy to do that too. But I know you mentioned that you wanted to get some food. And then we could schedule a V2. But I'm really, the biggest thing for me is, right, we've talked about this time up until this point of the past and even the present of trees. And of forest. I think even forest, even more so than trees, about how important they are. How are you feeling, especially in the past 30 years since you first wrote this, A Forest Journey?
Yeah.
Are you hopeful about the future of trees? Do you think we're going to be able to get our act together? Do you think people can help stop deforestation and continue with some of the reforestation efforts we've been hearing about? Or do you feel otherwise?
Well, the problem with the human animal is the human animal wants to always be, or certain people want to be top on the totem pole. And so, there's lots of money to cut down the forests. You know, it's a big profit at making, and it's so difficult for people to say our survival rests on the trees. You know, let's find another way. Because planting, that's the whole problem of planting trees is it takes like maybe 100 years for the trees to become sequesters, taking in more carbon than giving out more carbon. It's in the epilogue. Read the epilogue, because it's called the New Forestry, which has is covered in the epilogue quite in detail, is people prior to 1990s, people anthropomorphized trees. They thought the younger, and you still get this from almost every, person who wants to cut trees, is that the young trees are, you know, vigorous, and the old trees are just, you know, like they send them to the nursing home, right? And the truth of the matter is the old growth is what takes in all the carbon and holds in all the carbon. The young trees actually transpire, you might say, more carbon than they take in. So you can't do what they call harvesting and get the benefits of trees. In fact, when I first began the project, and this is one of my, I guess, at least I have some kind of character. Here I was with no money and living in a friend's backyard. And there were these various forestry organizations that were willing to support me. But they had this whole idea of, you know, this mantra that forestry in America is a renewable, you know, industry. And this is totally false, because when you cut down trees at, if you treat trees as a harvest, you know, as a crop, you lose in the entire, like, benefits of trees in so many ways. One way is they don't hold in the carbon. They release, as I said, they release more carbon. We have to stop anthropomorphizing trees. Trees are not like humans. See, trees, the reason why trees can live so long is because they grow slowly.
Yeah.
For example, you have the bristle cone in California, which I believe are, you know, over 6,000 years old. And that's because they grow very slowly. It'll take maybe 30 years for them to grow a branch. So you can't think of trees as people. You have to think of trees as trees. Also, what really struck me as I continue to write the book is how important biodiversity is. Because, for example, you get rid of the herbivores and no longer do you have any control of the vegetation. And that causes, you know, great fires. And so if you leave the trees alone and allow the, and also, like we talked about, for example, pandemics, you know, it's like rubber bands. You change one aspect and then the other rubber bands have to react.
Good analogy, yeah.
And for example, a good example is in the Amazon. Oh, they have all these hydroelectric plants, right, in the Amazon. They're no longer working because they've cut down the, what do they call it? The goose that laid the golden egg. You know, they cut down the creators of the water.
Wow.
Because we don't think, and that's what I hope my book changes, you know, people's minds, is to look at trees as trees and what they do for us. Because the message in a forestry, I think you see time and time again, once we cut down the trees, we either move on and find someone else's trees to cut down, or we collapse. And so that's the same thing with the wildlife in the forest. You cut down the trees and all the creatures, you know, die. And so once again, like in the pandemic, why is this important? Because the forest maintains the balance between predators and and generalized animals. That keep a balance, and when that balance is broken, you get you know, diseases like, and I can think of three or four of them right away. One is Lyme disease, is the consequence of forest fragmentation. B is coronavirus. Three is Ebola. I mean, they've discovered that you can actually tell an area that will have an Ebola outbreak by the state of the old growth. in a area, if all the old growth is cut down, then you're going to have Ebola spread.
Wow.
And
So
everybody tries to find like a culprit, but they don't want to find the real cause. For example, with COVID, you know how they were looking for a lab escape?
Of course, yeah.
And you notice nobody's talking about that anymore.
Right, right.
And what's interesting is an article in, I believe it was Nature Magazine in 2017, they predicted one of the areas that would probably be an area of a pandemic would be Wuhan. And that's because Wuhan was about 40 years ago, was a wild area, no people, hardly any people. Hmm. And suddenly you just slammed, like the communists did, slammed in there like a city of what, 30, 40 million people? I believe that's the size of it. It's huge, right?
Mm-hmm. Huge.
And what you did was by doing that, you exposed, where do these creatures go? They go into the public space.
Yeah.
Wow. And the biggest problem is we don't think of ourselves, and this is the, now I'm getting into the Christian right wing. Yeah. You don't think of yourself or ourselves as animals.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just divine, as dependent on the forest as, like I said, we're animals and we get viruses, right? Or, we can't live on prayer. I mean, if we don't have water, it's a pretty bad situation. And it's the trees that create at least 40% of the water. And not to mention global warming, where you have like, 40% of America does not believe in global warming. And actually, in the jungles of Laos, I believe it's Laos and Cambodia, they're finding bats that have almost the same genome as the coronavirus that infected the world. It's the wilderness-urban interface. You see this everywhere. You see this like in Santa Barbara, where, people, as the city expands, the trees fall.
Yeah.
And this is what actually happened in New England, creating Lyme disease, where you have what's called the white-legged mouse. I believe it's white-legged or white-footed mouse. And it was like kept down in the woods by the predators, as I was talking to you about. And then suddenly you have no trees, you have no predators because they're dependent on the forest. And suddenly the pool, for the larva, become gurgling in joy. Lapping it up. And suddenly Lyme disease is becoming a major, I think if I'm right, that Lyme disease is a big problem.
Wow.
In the health world. So all these aspects, and then you have in the Amazon, you have malaria. Did you know that in a regular forest, the malaria, the carriers of malaria, mosquitoes are mainly safe from carrying the disease, but once you open up the woods, the malarial spreaders proliferate. Create all these tragedies by denying our relationship to the to the trees.
I mean, it just,
you know, just like you made a really interesting statement earlier that the end Permian extinction resembled very much what we're beginning to do today.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here we have, I mean, here we have it in your face, John Perlin, like first chapter, you know. Hopefully my book will have some effect, you know, to raise people to understand that we are forest people, because that's originally where we came out of. Because now this is another fascinating thing. God, you're getting me all revved up again. Is that, this is horrible for the Christian, right?
Go ahead.
Who are the great apes? Humans, chimpanzees,
orangutans,
gorillas, and orangutans. And did you know that the orangutans, chimpanzees, and humans all make their shelters out of wood? Chimpanzees, they make every day they build they find the best wood, they take it down, they make an incredible nest. In fact, some people are designing beds out of the shape of their nests.
Really?
They are. And orangutans do the same thing. And about 450,000 years ago, humans started taking down the nest they used to have in trees, and they're finding wood that is shaped like Lincoln logs to make human nests, and that's what we call a house.
Wow.
So, and remember, the human nest is all built out of wood too. I mean, you know, like all the what is it, 2x4s, framing is all done with wood.
Sure.
So we're just repeating the great ape predilection for building in wood.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm telling you, honestly, it's one of the most mind-blowing books I've ever read, A Forest Journey. And to me, it's comforting, right? I mean, it's a little bit disorienting knowing that we've kind of done this before and continue to do this, where we're knocking down trees and just not seeing the forest through the trees, right? That old analogy. And still expecting different results. But to me, it is very comforting to know how much really does revolve around something I'm hoping people are taking a little bit more stock into. Old growth, forests, trees. Really hoping that people read your book, understand this, and really take this message to heart, because it's an incredibly well-written book. It's gorgeous. And just speaking with you has been so helpful for me just to understand and kind of get my bearings on it. So I want to say this is for version one of this, because I think there's so much more we can go into.
Let's do another. Let me leave you with this. And this is my this is a lesson I learned from my solar work, is that originally the first satellites that went up, they ran on batteries, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you know, when you keep the lights on and you leave your lights on as your car sits at night in a garage, you have to call the AAA, right?
Right.
But if you're in space, you can't. So the satellites would go down. So someone suggested solar cells, but everyone opposed it because it might not work. But it would solve the problem. And so what I learned was that people are happier with assured failure than they are with the possibility of success. How's that?
Well, that's a great way to end part one. I 100% agree. John, thank you so much for your time. Again, both with writing this book and with speaking with me. I'm very excited for part two, part three, whatever else we have after this. But
yeah, let's go. Let's do it.
Thanks for joining. If you liked that episode, feel free to rate, view, and subscribe. That actually really helps. If you haven't seen it yet, take a look at the accompanying blog. Don't forget your boots.com.
where you can read more and see photos for all the interviews. Until next time, take care.